Hello and welcome to the Media Matters podcast presented by myself, Colette Sexton, news correspondent at the Sunday Business Post. In each episode, we talk to an expert in the media and marketing industry and pick their brain on the topics that matter. This month, we've gone international as my guest, Gerard Royal, is coming to us over Skype from Australia. Gerard is usually based in Washington, where he heads up the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, an independent organization which includes journalists in more than 190 media companies in over 70 countries. They work together on issues such as cross-border crime, corruption, and the accountability of power. The ICIJ might not be a household name, but the projects that they worked on in recent years have generated hundreds of headlines. The Panama Papers and the more recently released Paradise Papers have shown Joe Public how politicians, multinationals, celebrities, and high net worth individuals use complex structures to pay less tax. The Kerry man spent over two decades as an investigative reporter and editor before joining the ICIJ as director in 2011. Gerard, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So the burning question is, how did a man from Tralee living in Australia end up running the ICIJ, which is based in Washington?
It's a bit of a long, convoluted story, but actually, I went to university for a year on a fellowship to Michigan, University of Michigan. And after about 5 years of being back in Australia, the director of that program just happened to be on the board of the organization that then ran the ICIJ, and they were looking for a new director, and they basically wanted someone who wasn't American, because up to that point they'd all been American directors. And I didn't know at the time that it had nothing to do with me so much as that they actually needed somebody for fundraising reasons who wasn't American. And so that's how I got the job.
And did you have any idea what the ICIJ was at that time?
Look, I'd heard about it over the years, because I've been an investigative reporter for almost two decades at that point. So everyone kind of knew about the ICIJ. It was more of a club back then, though. It was a member organization that really got together every couple of years, talked about investigative reporting. And when it had money, it would do the odd story. But as far as I could see, it hadn't really reached a potential. And when I got the opportunity, of course, it was a chance to really, do international investigative reporting. And I just couldn't say no.
And so what's your day-to-day job like?
Well, it's a very strange job, because we're a nonprofit, so we rely entirely on donations to survive. So part of my job is to try and raise that money. Part of my job is to direct whatever project we're directing. So I'm kind of like editor-in-chief. I'm also one of the main fundraisers for the organization. But also we've got to manage a lot of media organizations around the world. So we basically build tools that allow us to manage each organization as to bring them into the collaboration. So if we're doing a big project like the Paradise Papers, and you're dealing with reporters in 70 odd countries, then there's an awful lot of management involved in the reporter. We like to deal with the reporters themselves rather than their management. So it's, talking to reporters that asking them about their stories, making sure that they're telling everyone else about the story. So it's kind of a mixture of everything. And every now and again, and it's unfortunate not very often these days, is I actually get to do some research on the story itself.
So you're more so the boss these days than the actual reporter getting into the ground with everything that's happening in the story.
Yeah, I tend to, at the beginning of each project, do a lot of research, because I've got enough time to do that. But once the project itself gets underway, then I have to step back, and I've got a good staff that manages all the reporters around the world. Sometimes, we have 400 reporters in 70 odd countries working on a story. So you can imagine how much time that takes and how much management that takes.
I'm sure. I mean, how on earth do you manage to coordinate investigations like the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers across different countries, different languages, different cultures, and ensure that everyone adheres to the rules that you guys set down?
Well, it's very important at the beginning of each investigation to set the rules. So our rules are usually pretty simple. It's just, if we share the information, we expect every reporter to share their findings with everybody else. And we also impose a deadline for the story. Someone has to decide among all these different media partners when we're going to publish. And the ICIJ and basically me, I decide that. But obviously we do it with a lot of consultation. But after that, it's about technology. We've built an online newsroom where the reporters can go from their physical newsroom into this online newsroom every day. They can share everything with their fellow reporters, and they can see who's there, who's live. They can chat to each other. They can share information. They can take requests. You know, they might, someone, for instance, from Brazil might decide that they need a court case from Ireland that's relevant to our story. Then the Irish reporter can go and get that court case and upload it to our virtual newsroom. And we also build these other online tools that allow the reporters to search documents very easily. So you can put in every member of the Irish Parliament and their wives and children into a spreadsheet and search our document base pretty quickly. And that's really a very important part of what ICIJ does. We really provide the technology for the newsrooms around the world.
That's very interesting, because a lot of the journalists that you work with, I'm sure, have been in journalism for a couple of decades and probably originally weren't trained up in how to use that kind of technology. So is that an issue in getting people, getting their heads around that kind of new tech?
Yeah, look, I'm not the most technical myself. So, yes, it is a bit of a struggle sometimes, you know, making, and we also, you know, our security has ratcheted up over the years, as every time we do one of these projects, we become better known. And therefore, we're also being targeted by people who want to stop us doing it. So we have to train the journalist into, you know, basically using two-factor authentication, going into databases and things like that. Or, you know, at some point, we even now impose certificates on every single computer, so you can only get into our databases, you know, using these techniques. And but, you know, you can learn them. Even old people like me can learn them pretty easily these days. And it's amazing what you can do as a reporter these days using technology. I mean, it's almost impossible to even think about a time when we couldn't use computer-assisted reporting in these kinds of investigations.
Yeah, I do even myself a lot sit down and think, how on earth did anyone ever research a story without having, you know, Google there to back you up on anything? It must have been it was a completely different time. But do you think that means it's an amazing time to be an investigative journalist now, because all these tools are at your disposal?
Well, I think if you're not using them, then you're not doing your job properly. But I also think that we're in a different era. I mean, when I started in, you know, reporting, I would find it very difficult to get information. And that was a big challenge as a reporter. You'd go to, say, a company registrar in Australia, where I worked for many years, and you'd hand in a form, you fill in a form, you'd hand it in, and then you go in the next day and you might get some information back. And of course, that would lead to new queries. So you'd have to go again, fill out another form. And you can see that, you know, it takes days and days to do things that now only take seconds. So the real challenge these days is about how do you deal with large amounts of information. In other words, getting the information is no longer the problem. It's how to distill that information. That's the real challenge of the modern reporter.
And indeed, how to protect that information, I'm sure, is also something that's at the forefront of your mind at all times.
Well, I mean, you know, you're also, it's old fashioned still. I mean, you still got to get sources that give you information. You're still dealing with those old fashioned methods. But the information that can be gathered by sources these days is enormous compared to the old days. I mean, you know, every investigation we've been involved in, and I just was looking at something today, we've actually now been involved in the five biggest data leaks in history. So, and each one of them seemed to be getting bigger. With the Panama Papers, it was about 11.5 million documents. With the Paradise Papers, it was 13.5 million. So it's inevitable that large data sets are going to become part and parcel of journalism going forward.
I mean, that's just mind-boggling, the sheer amount of content within that. It's not something that even if you had that much information back in the old days that you'd ever be able to put together an investigation on, unless you did have the technology. It's fascinating.
But also the people. I mean, you know, the fact that we're able to get so many reporters from so many countries, you know, speaking so many different languages, looking at these documents, it does allow us to do journalism that is much better than the journalism we've done in the past. Because, I mean, they're all bringing different attitudes. They're all bringing different experience to the table. And they're also able to tell you in seconds, you know, who's important to their country and who isn't important to their country. And I think that makes for a much better journalism. And it also gives the public, I guess, in the era of fake news, it gives the public a reassurance that what they're seeing, with the final product that we produce, is actually something that's been, you know, very well thought out.
And in terms of those individual journalists, I mean, they do have the support network of being able to log on to their computers and talk to someone, as you said, in Brazil or wherever. And so in that way, they're not working alone. But within their own newsrooms, often their colleagues don't know that they're working on this story because obviously it's so sensitive. How do you make sure that no one leaks?
Well, it really is. When they find something, it's very important for an investigative reporter to have that moment of joy when you find something important as you go along. I mean, you know, in the newsroom, it's easier because you can turn to your news editor or your boss and say, hey, I've just found the prime minister or the Taoiseach or something. It's difficult with this because we obviously have a cone of silence for sometimes up to a year. And the way they get around it is really by telling each other. You know, when you find something great, you scream about it on this online, in this online newsroom, and you let everyone know about it. And then everyone, you know, jumps in and praises you and gives you that little pat on the back that you need. And that energizes you to go forward. And it also energizes everyone around you, because if someone in Brazil is finding great material and then the next day someone in France is finding something great, it's an amazing energy that you get from doing these stories, where every day you wake up, because we've automated all of this so that if you're interested in a particular topic, take any topic, basically say it's politics in Ireland, we can set up automatic alerts so that every day, if someone finds something new about the Irish political scene, you're being alerted to it. So you're waking up in the morning and you might have 20 or 30 new leads to chase that day. And it's a great way of reporting.
And so, to date, what has been your proudest moment as head of the ICIJ?
I think just putting us on the world map in a way that has never, you know, it never had been before. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I still think we're probably best known for the Panama Papers investigation, because we did bring down two governments. We brought down the government of Iceland and the government of Pakistan. So I guess they're like crowning achievements. But it's the fact that it took almost 3 to 4 years of previous investigations to get to that point. The sort of, to know that the methodology that we put in place when I took over back in, you know, September 2011, you know, let's do it this way. This is going to work. And at the time, people were skeptical. I remember going to newsrooms around the world and waiting in the lobby for sometimes hours at a time, trying to get someone to actually listen to what I was trying to say. And to now know that that actually works, and that newsrooms in all around the world now are basically copying our methods and they're doing it. And to share stories is now becoming quite commonplace in journalism, because people can see that, in some cases at least, it actually works.
Mm. And is there any issue in getting newsrooms or editors to dedicate that much of their reporters' time to an investigation like this when, you know, newsrooms are stretched budget-wise?
Well, we do bring a lot of sort of savings to the table, because we share information, we share graphics, photographs, things like that, that are quite expensive. So we're very cost effective for newsrooms, which is, I think, one of the reasons why they allow us to happen. But we learned very early on that you're better off dealing with reporters, because reporters, it doesn't matter what language they speak, they understand a good story. And if you go to a reporter with a good story, you're more likely to get them to do the advocacy inside their newsrooms that you need. So in other words, rather than going to the bosses, like when I first started off, that's what I was doing, I realized, no, it's, if you can connect with a reporter in a newsroom, they will do all the internal politics that you need in order to get the time that they need for the story. And that's really worked for us enormously well.
Yes, reporters do tend to fight for their stories. That's an excellent strategy on your behalf. And then, Gerard, in terms of the other side of your job, so the fundraising side, has it been easier to raise money since the Panama Papers?
Yeah, there's no doubt it has been. We've actually gone independent as well. So we brought the ICIJ independent. We went independent in February this year, and that was a big risk for us. Up to that point, we'd been part of a larger American organization, and we were kind of like an appendage to that organization, whereas now our methodology, everything we do is completely controlled by us. And we've actually managed to double our income since the Panama Papers. So yeah, things are going very well for us. But of course, you know, you're only as good as your next story, and you're only as good as the money you can raise in the future.
And Gerard, in terms of the number of organizations that are a part of the ICIJ now, have you guys kind of reached a plateau in that you don't want any more joining, or are you always looking for more?
Well, it's a strange thing, because the ICIJ began as a member organization, in other words, a member of journalist organization. So about 20 years ago, they decided to form this ICIJ, and they basically went to well-known reporters around the world and invited them to be members. And it was very much a member organization for many, many years, where these members would get together. It was like a network. Where we have changed in the last 5 or 6 years is that we've become much more also an organization of media partners. And there's no formal media partners for ICHA, so we were happy to work with pretty much anyone, as long as it's a harmonious, basically team. In other words, we think very clearly if we have a story. I mean, we're very story driven. I mean, the whole thing only works if we find a great story, then we can get the reporters interested. So we have to find the stories first. And so each story will dictate who we need to work for the who we need to work with us on each story. Like with the Panama Papers, we had never worked with a reporter in Iceland, but quite clearly early on, it was going to be very important that we find somebody to work with. And so we reached out to our network, and our Swedish journalist basically recommended this journalist called Johannes Christensen, who we ended up working with, and well, the rest is history. Basically, he brought his government down.
So, I mean, clearly then that you're basing it on word of mouth and people that can tell you can trust these people, because obviously you don't want to go along with someone that you might end up taking down the whole investigation.
Yeah, we've learned as we've gone along. We've made mistakes. So there's no doubt that we made mistakes when we started doing this, and we learned from that. It's a bit like the best analogy is really, it's a bit like having a dinner party. You want everyone at that dinner party to be good conversationalists, and you need to know that they're going to bring something to the table. And that's how we really work. If we like working with somebody, we'll tend to work with them again. If we find that they, that isn't good for the team or isn't sharing, because it's very important that there's a huge amount of trust between the journalists, because we don't want anyone to scoop anyone. You know, it's very important. I mean, it's the most fundamentally important thing here is that if we give you the information, that you don't go ahead and publish until everyone's ready to publish together. And so you need to have that element of trust. But we found that, you know, as we've been doing this with the smaller investigations, when I say smaller, sometimes it would be like 40 countries involved. It seems small now. There would be a trust and a bond that would build up over those reporters that would then carry on to the new ones that you bring in. Because there's a lot of skepticism at the beginning, because it's the opposite of what we've been taught to do as journalists, you know, which is basically journalists are usually lone wolves, especially investigative reporters, and they don't like to share information. And so you have to convince them to do something that they've never done before, which is to share. And they need to know that if they do share, that their story is going to be better at the end, not worse.
So, Gerard, digging into your own background a bit, it seems like journalism is the family business for you. So your great-grandfather, Morris P. Royle, was editor of the Kerry People, the Evening Herald, and deputy editor of the Irish Independent, I believe. So is that history the reason why you became a journalist?
I think it was maybe partly, yeah. But I mean, I am not sure why I became a journalist, mainly because it's probably the only thing that I was qualified to do, to be really honest. You know, I got into Rathmines College coming out of school, and I was very lucky to get in there, I think. And then it just went from there. I just really enjoyed it. And I guess I just found my calling. Up to that point, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do.
So why did you end up moving to Australia?
Well, I worked for a couple of years in Ireland in provincial newspaper, actually. I worked at Sligo Champion, Longford Leader, and Longford News. And like most sort of young reporters at that point, it was very difficult to get into the Dublin media, which is where we all wanted to be. And then I interviewed some people who'd come back from Australia. They talked about how amazing it was. And I thought, well, you know, why wait knocking on doors when maybe I can, you know, move along a bit faster. So I had a cousin in Australia. I wrote to them and they invited me to come over, and I just went to Melbourne out of the blue. I didn't know it, and I've done very, very little research, but it was very easy to get a visa at the time. It was a 1-year visa. And I thought, what the hell, I'll just take a chance and go away for a year. What have I got to lose?
And how did you find working as a reporter in Australia compared to in Ireland?
Well, I got very lucky when I landed in Melbourne. I had written to a few of the newspapers there, and I managed to get a week's work at one of the big newspapers called The Age in Melbourne, which was much bigger than any of the Dublin papers that I've been trying to get into. And so, and then I, at the end of that first week, I went up and asked them if I could come back the following week, and went on like that for almost 5 months before they finally said to me, well, we might as well employ you full time. And at the end of the year, when my visa ran out, they said they wanted to keep me. So then they sponsored me into the country. And that's how it went. It was very different, but it was also very free because, I mean, basically, I didn't know anyone and I could reinvent myself. You know, at that point, it didn't matter that I was just a small time newspaper reporter from rural Ireland. You know, I could be whatever I wanted to be. And I guess, you know, Australia gave me that break.
So you've worked across different newspapers in different continents, and now you work with journalists across the world. Do you think that there is a future for independent investigative journalism?
Look, I think there is. I don't think journalism itself is broken. I think at the moment what's broken is the business model that is supporting journalism, because, you know, up till now it's about advertising. And advertising, you know, was a very lucrative industry for many years. And journalism was really just an appendage to the advertising industry, if we really think about it clearly. And at the moment, that isn't working. And so the journalism is suffering, or there's nowhere there to fund journalism. So I think we're in a period of transition. But I don't think it's necessarily bad, because it allows us to re-examine what we're supposed to be doing in the first place, and allows us, I think, in some ways to basically do better journalism, because it's now about the journalism rather than it being just something that, because you made so much money, you did on the side.
And have you seen newspapers that have been able to fix that model through your work, to fix the business model?
There are a couple of models that are working. There's actually a model in France that basically is a website that charges people to look at it, and it's thriving. There's also a membership model working very well in Korea. One of our members of our team, basically, they're doing very well. They've managed to convince 30,000 people to basically give them a fee every year to support them. But it's, you know, and in some parts of the world, journalism is really thriving. It's very commercial. In India, for instance, newspapers are thriving, and then the media is thriving in India. It's just in some parts of the West, like in Ireland and England and America, that it's actually not going so well.
And would you be a supporter of a subscription-based model or freemium models, or what The Guardian's doing in trying to get people to donate and give out all of their information for free?
Look, I think everyone's struggling to look for that new business model. And if I knew what it was going to be, I'd be very wealthy. So I'm not going to pretend I know. But it's interesting, you know, it's an interesting time for experiment. And that's what you're seeing at the moment. You're seeing the old business models struggling, and the new business models somehow emerging, I think, from that wreckage. And, I think journalism itself is fine. I mean, we've got bigger readership, more readership, more listenership, as evidenced by, you know, what we're doing right now. Even 5 or 6 years ago, it was not even possible. So it's not like people aren't hearing what we're saying or reading what we're writing. It's just that the business model itself isn't working quite so well at the moment.
Do you keep an eye on changes to the media landscape in Ireland?
Oh, yeah, no, I read the Irish newspapers every day. And we obviously work with the Irish Times on a regular basis on our stories. And I'd like to work actually with more Irish media. I think it's, you know, the issue with Ireland is that, like every small place, it's, you know, when you have a dominance of media owners, it's very hard to do real journalism. It's also the other thing that Ireland has, unfortunately, is that libel and defamation laws in Ireland are pretty draconian, and because they're based on the British system. And having worked in that same system for many years in Australia, it's very hard to be a journalist, basically, in Ireland. And I would find it very difficult to work there. I find it very, it's very free to be able to work out of the US, where you do have constitution protection, freedom of speech. Where I'm able to publish stories and do things that I was never able to do in Australia or when I was in Ireland. And I do think that, you know, the Irish need to re-examine that, because it's, you know, it's just not good for society.
Yeah, when you have celebrities flying to Ireland to use our system to sue people, there's definitely something wrong there.
Yeah, it's wrong, because it's really just, it's all about the legal profession making lots of money rather than have an actual debate about freedom of speech. Having said that, I do think that a lot of the journalism that we practice under that system, and I say that very broadly, is not very good journalism. And I do think that there's a compromise here. I do think that we need to get better with our fact-checking. We need to get better with going to people sooner for comment, to give them a better chance to put context around what we're seeing. So journalists need to get better. But the system itself is not there to encourage good journalism, because basically you can't really tell the truth. And if you do tell the truth, you've got to get sued. So it's kind of, there's a kind of it's not a good system.
And do you think that there's a problem with the people that are getting into journalism in Ireland? Because obviously there's media organizations do not have the funds that they used to have, and as a result there are a lot of, you know, zero hour contracts and freelance work that isn't, you know, going to pay the mortgage at the end of the day. There's a lot of people working for free to try and break into the industry, and as you said yourself, you were able to go to Australia and end up in one of their biggest papers so quickly compared to getting into a national here. Do you think that maybe Irish journalism is becoming a bit elitist?
Well, I mean, I think there are two points to be made here. I do think that that journalism is elitist, generally speaking. I mean, there's an old saying in NPR in the US that you only work for NPR if you can afford to work for NPR. And I do think that journalism has very much got into the upper middle classes, and we only used to write and report for the upper middle classes. So we've got to be very careful there. But in terms of going back, I mean, I started off back in, gosh, 20, 30 years ago now. And, you know, and I worked for free. I mean, my first job at the Sligo Champion, I was working for the dole. You know, it's just, you know, I think journalists will always find a way. If you want to be a journalist, you'll always find a way to be a journalist. And you know, it's just that we've had a good 20 or 30 years in between where organizations were making a lot of money out of this, and newspapers were thriving, and advertising was thriving, and the number of journalists grew in that period. It wasn't always so good, and I think, you know, I don't think it's necessarily changed at the moment.
Would you ever be interested in returning to Ireland for work?
Yeah, I wouldn't say no to anything, actually. I mean, I go back to Ireland a lot. My parents and all of my family are there, so
You haven't lost the accent.
Well, I mean, I feel Irish, you know, even though I'm an Australian now and I got dual citizenship and my wife's Australian, I still feel, I still feel Irish more than anything else. And when I'm in America, I describe myself as Irish rather than anything else, even though I'm there on an Australian passport. So you never lose your, you never lose it, basically. You know, you always have that feeling for home.
So we had Panama in 2016, Paradise in 2017. Is there something up the ICIJ's sleeve for 2018?
Oh, look, we're always looking for new stories. I mean, it's one of the things that was occupying my day today was, what are we going to do next? It's the problem with investigative reporting, though. You always have this, love-hate relationship with the story you're working on, because you really want to get it done and you really want it to work. But you know that the moment you publish, you're going to be feeling like, you know, like you've given birth, and you feel very empty. And it's actually very difficult sometimes to cope with mentally. I mean, a lot of our reporters, we have to give them, like, around the world, we give them like quiet counseling that once these things publish, you're going to feel a bit down afterwards. And you just learn, it's something that I've learned to cope with over the years. And the only way to cope with it is to know that there's always going to be something better around the corner. There's always going to be something bigger around the corner. And people never believe that. Every story we've done has been bigger than the last. So I've got a great belief that we have something bigger.
Right, well, we look forward to seeing what's around the corner for the ICIJ. So, Gerard, listen, thanks a million for taking the time to talk to me. That's all for this installment of the Media Matters podcast. Thanks so much to Gerard Royal for taking the time to chat to me. And thanks to you all for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please share Media Matters on your social media channels, rate us on iTunes, and subscribe. If you have feedback or any suggestions for future interviewees, tweet me on Colette_Sexton. Until next time,